Chrome Yellow by August Huxley, read for LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 29. It was after 10 o'clock. The dancers had already dispersed, and the last lights were being put out. Tomorrow the tents would be struck, the dismantled merry-go-round would be packed into wagons and carted away. An expanse of worn grass, a shabby brown patch and wide green of the park would be all that remained. Chrome Fair was over. By the edge of the pool, two figures lingered. "No, no, no," Anne was saying in a breathless whisper, leaning backwards, turning her head from side to side in an effort to escape Gombauld's kisses. "No, please, no," her raised voice had become imperative. Gombauld relaxed his embrace a little. "Why not?" he said. "I will." With a sudden effort, Anne freed herself. "You won't," she retorted. "You've tried to take the most unfair advantage of me." "Unfair advantage?" echoed Gombauld in genuine surprise. "Yes, unfair advantage. You attack me after I've been dancing for 2 hours while I'm still reeling drunk with the movement, when I've lost my head and when I've got no mind left but only a rhythmical body. It's as bad as making love to someone you've drugged or intoxicated." Gombauld laughed angrily. "Call me a white slaver and have done with it." "Luckily," Anne said, "I am now completely sobered, and if you try and kiss me again, I shall box your ears." "Shall we take a few turns round the pool?" she added. "The night is delicious." For answer, Gombauld made an irritated noise. They paced off slowly, side by side. "What I like about the Comte de Degas," Anne began in her most detached and conversational tone. "Oh, damn Degas," Gombauld was almost shouting. From where he stood, leaning in an attitude of despair against the parapet of the terrace, Denis had seen them, the two pale figures in a patch of moonlight far down by the pool's edge. He had seen the beginning of what promised to be an endless, passionate embracement, and at the sight he had fled. It was too much, he couldn't stand it. In another moment he felt he would have burst into irrepressible tears. Dashing blindly into the house, he almost ran into Mr. Scogan, who was walking up and down the hall, smoking a final pipe. "Hello," said Mr. Scogan, catching him by the arm. Dazed and hardly conscious of what he was doing or where he was, Denis stood there for a moment like a somnambulist. "What's the noiselessly along the passage and began to mount the stairs toward the higher floors. Arrived at the servants' quarters under the roof, he hesitated, then turning to the right, he opened a little door at the end of the corridor. Within was a pitch-dark, cupboard-like pottery pot, stuffy and smelling of dust and old leather. He advanced cautiously into the blackness, groping with his hands. It was from this den that the ladder went up to the leads of the western tower. He found the ladder and set his feet on the rungs. Noiselessly he lifted the trapdoor above his head. The moonlight sky was over him. He breathed the fresh, cool air of the night. In a moment he was standing on the leads, gazing out over the dim, colourless landscape, looking perpendicularly down at the terrace 70 feet below. Why had he climbed up to this high, desolate place? Was it to look at the moon? Was it to commit suicide? As yet he hardly knew. Death, the tears came into his eyes when he thought of it. His misery assumed a certain solemnity. He was lifted up on the wings of a kind of exaltation. It was a mood in which he might have done almost anything, however foolish. He advanced towards the farther parapet. The drop was sheer there and uninterrupted. A good leap and perhaps one might clear the narrow terrace and so crash down yet another 30 feet to the sun-baked ground below. He paused at the corner of the tower, looking now down into the shadowy gulf below, now up towards the rare stars and the waning moon. He made a gesture with his hand, muttered something he could not afterwards remember what, but the fact that he had said it aloud gave the utterance a peculiarly terrible significance. Then he looked down once more into the depths. "What are you doing, Dennis?" questioned the voice from somewhere very close to him. Dennis uttered a cry of frightened surprise and very nearly went over the parapet in good earnest. His heart was beating terribly and he was pale when, recovering himself, he turned round in the direction from which the voice had come. "Are you ill?" In the profound shadow that slept under the eastern parapet of the tower, he saw something he had not previously noticed, an oblong shape. It was a mattress and someone was lying on it. Since that first memorable night on the tower, Mary had slept out every evening. It was a sort of manifestation of fidelity. "It gave me a fright," she went on, "to wake up and see you waving your arms and gibbering then. What on earth were you doing?" Dennis laughed melodramatically. "What indeed?" he said. Poor Mary, he was very sorry for her. Still, she might have guessed that Ivor wasn't precisely a monument of constancy. Well, she concluded, one must put a good face on it. She wanted to cry, but she wouldn't allow herself to be weak. There was a silence. Do you think, asked Dennis, hesitating, do you really think that she, that Gromble? I'm sure of it, Mary answered decisively. There was another long pause. I don't know what to do about it, he said at last, utterly dejected. You'd better go away, advised Mary. It's the safest thing and the most sensible. But I've arranged to stay here 3 weeks more. You must concoct an excuse. I suppose you're right. I know I am, said Mary, who was recovering all her firm self-possession. You can't go on